Richards, reel 6.
And this was the wrong way that a man of his caliber should have been treated. He was just a weak person, and nobody warranted any imprisonment whatsoever. They'd already done their terms of imprisonment. Nobody, in my knowledge, done anything against anybody in our camp. So I'm quite convinced about that fact.
You mentioned the broadcast which very senior American officers who were POWs made. Did you hear those yourself?
Yes. Colonel Schwabel was an American Air Force commander who was captured, and he was giving his voice was relayed over our speaker system, telling us how well he'd been treated, and Chinese are very kind and thoughtful people and all this sort of thing. And also General Dean, who was an army general who'd been captured on the front. His jeep broke down, I think, or something like that. And he was broadcasting how wonderfully it had been treated and all this sort of thing. So I don't see why they should just pick on some colonels and that, saying they'd been well treated and want to sue for peace and all that sort of thing, you know, and not high-ranking officers. It seemed peculiar to me that they should say, I mean, they've done just the same thing by broadcasting to the ordinary troops, haven't they?
What kind of impact did these statements by these two senior American officers have on you as a POW?
Well, we all thought they'd been forced to say it, but then again, knowing the Chinese, nobody was forced to do or say anything. I've never seen anybody forced. Some people may have a different story to tell about that, but as far as I was concerned, I've never been forced to say anything. I've been asked to say certain things at times before by a Korean officer once, and he told me I was worse than Winston Churchill when I argued with him, and I thought that was an honour at the time.
What did he ask you to say?
No, he wanted me to say that Britain was a warmongering nation and they were prepared to, looking for trouble all over the world. And I said, they are not a warmongering nation. We've just had a world war where we've been almost destroyed, really. I mean, the whole of our economy was in such a state, wasn't it? If you remember, well, you wouldn't remember, but 1946, we didn't even have enough coal. We were still on rationing for years. And the cities were all flattened. London was still great big holes and gaps everywhere, and other cities like Portsmouth and places like that. And I said, no, I said, that's completely wrong. I said, and that is a ridiculous statement to say, you see. And he told me I was worse than Winston Churchill, and he hit me round the face with his gloved hand, which I didn't like. I think that was humiliating to me. So anyway, I reported him to a higher rank, a colonel, who used to come and visit our company. At that time, this is when we were with the Koreans, and he was moved. So they took a dim view of it. You see, they're not allowed to strike a prisoner. So, I mean, it may have happened on odd occasions to other prisoners, I don't know. But I have never seen anybody struck apart from that, which wasn't a strike. It was just a matter of doing that with a gloved hand, which was humiliating because I couldn't do anything back. But nevertheless, I complained bitterly about it. I said that I was struck. I wasn't hurt, but that I was struck and it hurt me more inside than the blow of it. And he was shifted, never saw him again. Captain Hahn. Captain Hahn, his name was, very smart looking bloke, but he had a bit of a temper. And that was earlier days.
You've given a picture of quite reasonable treatment by
them. I think so.
Did you ever hear of anybody being physically assaulted or tortured?
Well, myself, now, early days when the sergeants and officers were in our camp, I saw one sergeant that had been beaten up. He'd got cut eye. He'd been obviously been punched by somebody or the other. And this was very early days. He is the only person I've ever seen assaulted. And I never saw him get assaulted, but it was obvious that he had been. And the story went round that he'd been beaten up.
Did he tell you why he had been hit?
No. In fact, the sergeants were moved out very shortly after because they separated all the senior NCOs in one camp. All the officers went away to another camp. I've read books since of people like Wooden Boxes. I don't know if you've read the book.
No.
There's a couple of other British Army personnel supposed to have been put in boxes and things like that and badly treated. Well, they may be true. I mean, I'm not denying their story. I find it very difficult to believe. But then again, if you get somebody who's going to be any sort of discipline or anything, then they can expect, I suppose, some sort of bad treatment themselves. I mean, at times we deliberately upset them if we could by, for instance, when I used to tell him what teeth were, tusks and things like that. Well, I would expect to get a clump or something like that, really, but nothing was ever done to me. But if I was to continually do everything they say, against everything they say, refuse to do this, refuse to do that, then I would have expected harsher treatment, you know. So I wasn't prepared to do that. I was prepared to sort of move along with the times and get back home. That's all I was interested in doing.
Was there much baiting of the guards?
At the beginning, yes. At the end, no. In fact, we became so friendly with them in the end. Nearly all the guards couldn't speak English, just a few odd words. They were all old Kuomintang soldiers or people like that. And some of them were really friendly, really, really friendly. I had a friend who was very early days, when we were all sick with dysentery and that. And he was an ex-Marine during the last war. He was at Auckland, the Battle of Auckland on the islands off of Holland. And he'd been in the commandos during the war. And he was out in Korea as a regular. And because not all of them were volunteers, some were called to go out there, sent out there, you see. And he said he was very ill with pneumonia. He had double pneumonia. And, of course, it was such a vicious winter, that first winter. And he was dying. I know that this Chinese, we called them war comrades. That was the name we gave him. And his name was Comrade, can't think of his name. We called him Ding Ho, which is very good in Chinese because he was such a good chap. He was a man from Peking, and in civilian life he used to play the violin and orchestra. And whether he joined up or called up, we don't know. But he was a smashing chap, didn't speak very much English at all. But he gave his, they used to get us an egg ration every now and again when we were only getting sorghum. I mean, they'd have a little better now and again. Not very often. Otherwise, they ate the same as we did. But he used to give it to Harry Melling, to help him while he was ill. His own ration. This was a guard. And we couldn't fathom that out at that time, you know. But Harry died and he was an old friend of mine, Harry Melling. I knew him in 42 Commando before I was going out there. So they're not all bad people, you know. There's some super people among them.
What form did the baiting take in the early days?
Well, for instance, we used to go swimming and things like that out in the Yalu River. And we used to pile our clothes and swim in the nude. Obviously, no women around or anything. Swim, pile our clothes and just go out and swim, you see. Well, we were allowed a certain distance out because over the river, the other side is China. And we used to go out a certain distance and then if the guard saw you going too far, he'd fire a shot in front, not at you, really, but well, we used to tease them as much as possible, you know, and go as to the limit. Knowing now that we wouldn't be shot, really, because names have been exchanged. You see, after the names have been exchanged, they've got something to answer for. If, you know, too many people were to be shot or something like that, I suppose. That's the way we looked at it anyway. But that sort of thing. Well, then he used to get his own back by taking your clothes. Then he used to have to go running after your clothes later on. See, then you get a telling off. To steal anything was a terrible thing. They looked down on stealing. We used to have to get up and confess to everybody that we stole the people's property. Everything belonged to the people, according to them. Very simple-minded, aren't they, really? I think even today, Chinese are very simple-minded people. I mean, they're intelligent, don't get me wrong, but they're simple in their ways of explaining things, see? And out there, of course, things were very short. And I pinched a candle one day while I was typing up. We used to have little bits of string for wick in a bit of oil for a lamp, in a bit of bean oil. And that used to run out, and we'd only have a certain amount every month, you know, a little drop every month. So we'd run out, and to have a bit of light in the night time for people to read or talk and that, I decided to pinch this half a candle, only a little tiny piece of a candle in the headquarters. I got caught. So I had to tell everybody how wicked I was for pinching their candle, the people's candle, and I shouldn't ever do it, you know, because it belongs to the people and not just to me and all this sort of thing. Well, that's all we said, but I mean, what a lot of rubbish, all over a piece of candle. Oh, and then we used to steal extra firewood. If they brought a barge in from over from China, there was no wood available up in our part of North Korea. So they used to bring it in by barges and that, or over the ice by sledges in the winter. And one day they used to line up, you see, the guards and that, and we used to come up with like a stretcher with all these logs laid on top, already chopped for us, you see, by the peasants of China, I suppose. And we'd run up to our cookhouse with them, you see. Well, everything had to go to the cookhouse and was allocated from there, like a store. And what we used to do is take a little dive around the corner of our hut and empty it in our own roof. You see, well, we got caught doing that. Often people go, all we had to do then is to confess and say how wicked we were to steal the people's firewood. Yeah, but it's so cold, we need to lie. Well, everybody's take it as a laugh, like, oh, funny they are.
You were talking about escape earlier. Did your escape attempts get very far?
No, nobody ever escaped from North Korea, as far as I know. Not one. Many people tried, several tried from our camp. They were brought back, one or two probably got shot on the way, or, you know, by civilians, attacked by the civilians, would hate us, really. I forgot to mention that on the march back, the civilians tried to get at us with pitchforks, because they're all peasant farmers and that out of the way. And tried to jab us as we went by, you know, with pitchforks, you know, in their lingo. And of course the Chinese kept them off, but good job they did, otherwise we'd have been speared. But
jab you in a vicious way?
Yes, sir, yeah, they didn't like us. I mean, they were being harangued and bombed every 2 minutes. And But nobody ever escaped, as far as I know. I know several people tried. Farrar Hockley tried, didn't he? But he didn't get anywhere. You see, everything's against you. Your height, your walking, your stance. Food, well, you just wouldn't be able to live on the countryside. And to get anywhere in North Korea is impossible without a helicopter. They're so steep, these hills. It's like the area around Everest, you know. You'd have to be a mountaineer extraordinaire. So unless you were moved near the coast or something like that, it was impossible. Everybody thought of it, as I say. Tried, some tried two or three times, but they just come back. They would have to stand up, confess to their stupidity in trying to escape and wasting the people's time. Everything belonged to people, you see. And that was it. Once you confessed, you were forgiven. So like a religion of sorts, I said.
There was a great deal said during the Korean War in the way of accusations by the Chinese that the United Nations forces had conducted germ warfare.
Mm.
What are your own feelings about all that?
Mm. Well, I never believed it when it first was announced. You know, we thought, well, there were more propaganda because all their news broadcasts were given to us from their angle, of course. And we said, oh, no, that's just a load of old lies they made up. And then they brought round some airmen. And we had two of them come and speak one day. Quinn was one of them. Do you know the names of them?
No.
Quinn, and I can't think of the other lieutenant's name, but they were B-25 pilots. And they gave us a talk in our hall and said that they had dropped these German bombs and they were ashamed and disgusted. And we thought, it must have been forced to say, you know. So I managed to get hold of one of them, and I can't think of his name. Not Quinn, his other chappie. And I asked him, I said, well, you been forced to say? Oh, no, he said, it's absolutely true. And in fact, while I was in the camp, he wrote me a letter while I was in the camp saying that what he'd done, exactly where he dropped it and everything.
Can you remember the details?
No, I had the letter up until some years, but it was made of that very cheap, rotten paper, and it just went away to pieces, you know. But he definitely confirmed he dropped them. So, I don't know what to believe anymore. I mean, I can't understand why he... I mean, there's nothing wrong with him. He hadn't been beaten up or anything. And I know they were caught after the war for it and all that. I don't know what happened about them, but it'll probably be worth trying to find out. I last told Tolan when I see him.
What did this chap look like?
The airman?
Yes.
He was dark-haired, the one I knew, and I think it was something like Newman or something like that. But Quinn was... they're both fairly young pilots, and they're both B-25 pilots. But there were four of them all together touring the camps and telling people that they drop bombs and germ bombs and all that sort of thing. I wouldn't put it across now. You know, I wouldn't put it past that the Americans would do that sort of thing. And then again, I mean, they use napalm. Well, that is a terrible weapon for a start. It's that jelly petrol. You saw it in Vietnam, and that was a dreadful thing, killing people.
Why did you think napalm was so bad?
It's so horrendous. I mean, if you see people are just stuck as they are like that in this jellied petrol, just burnt to a cinder, you know, it's dreadful. And there were nearly all civilian casualties that they were catching when we saw. Because of the houses, they were napalming houses and things like that, you know, it's a dreadful weapon. And unfortunately, the Chinese uniform that they were fighting is cotton wool padded in winter. And of course, cotton wool, when it catches light, oh, burns like a torch.
What kind of germs did these two pilots say they'd been dropping?
Supposed to have been a plague, bubonic plague and things like that, like the rats carry, you know. But, well, you don't know, do we? Of course, they deny it, America, but, I mean, who do you believe? I don't know.
Going back to the earlier days when, before you were captured, did you have much contact with South Korean troops?
No, we only had a few on the convoy on the night. We moved up from Coterie to Hagari on the day, I should have said, and when we were captured that night. That's the only time. No, we hadn't really had much contact with them. There's no difference between them, really. You wouldn't be able to tell a South Korean from a North Korean. In fact, one of the camp commanders in Camp 5 was assassinated by a South Korean agent. A Chinese commander was shot by a South Korean agent in our camp. We used to call him Cowboy, used to wear big Stetson. Very nice chap he was, didn't speak much English. Used to always speak to us in Chinese. But
Who used to wear the hat?
The Chinese camp commander. Used to wear a great big cowboy type hat, you know, a big white brim. And some agent came in one evening and shot him. South Korean agent he was reported to be, we don't know. But we never saw the camp commander anymore, he was killed. Whether it was meant to be an assassination attempt or whether it was somebody done it on his own, we don't know. He was a Korean anyway.
What were the circumstances of your release?
The peace talks had started to go on, you know, on and on for some considerable time. And eventually they were held up, weren't they, over the prisoner of war question. But when they were finally signed, we were told to go out on the parade one day. They kept us informed about how near the talks were going to be, how close they were getting to peace. And we went out on the parade this day and all the film cameras were set up, movie cameras, so we realised something was on. And the camp commander got up, spoke in Chinese, and then it was all translated. Everything they told us was put in Chinese first, even the lectures. It was such a bore to go through all this Chinese and then in English, so that they're lecturing their own people at the same time, you see. And he got up and said, well, we are so glad to tell everybody that peace has now arrived. The armistice has been agreed to, a ceasefire, I'm sorry, not an armistice, still only a ceasefire. It's been agreed to from such and such a time. And everybody just stood there. And they were upset, you see, because they expect everybody to jump and clap, you know. Nobody moved. We were so bored to tears with it. We were so fed up with all the waiting, nobody moved or anything like that. As funny it was. Spontaneous gesture by everybody. We just said, oh, good. And they were so amazed, you know, isn't anybody pleased, you know? It didn't do their camera work any good at all. Nobody was excited at all. Of course, we were underneath, really, I suppose. And they began to take us back down to Panmunjom in trucks. And we moved from trucks to the nearest railhead. And we moved all the way down North Korea by rail. And the devastation was unbelievable. And we went through Pyongyang and places like that. And they were completely flattened. Flattened. It wasn't... The craters either side of the railway line were continual all the way along, adjoining each other. It was unbelievable. And yet the railway was still working.
What condition were you in when you
Very good
back?
Condition. At the end, they met us with ambulances, the American Marines and troops. Marines to come and welcome us, and they grabbed either side of our armours. Our name was called. I was on about the third or fourth day of repatriation, and they grabbed us by our arm either side, you know, to help us. And I said, no, I don't need any help. I was quite, in fact, I really got back part of my weight and everything. And as I told you earlier, the food had him proved no end, and we were getting tinned beef and things like that, you know. They'd really done their best, I think, in the end. Probably knowing the war was going to finish soon, they had to make us look good. Oh, we had new clothes issued. And they gave us little books and things as mementos. And as we went through the Chinese side, one side of the prison camp staff, as we left, by the way, they were crying. Some of them were really crying. We got to be such friends, you know.
Who was crying?
The Chinese guards, the blokes that we'd been living with for the last couple of years or so. I mean, we got to know them so well. There was Comrade Wong. He was in tears that we were going, crying his eyes out. I've never seen, couldn't believe it, you know. And we felt sad in a way because we were saying goodbye, never to see him again, you know. Comrade Ying, I think his name is, he was American type China, but he was such a softy, such a nice person, you know. And he was crying his eyes out too, waving to us. He didn't seem right, you know. Of course, we're all glad to get back, by the way, don't get me wrong. So good people, some of them.
Did you Did your period of imprisonment in Korea change you in any way, do you think?
I think so. It's made me more tolerable to other people's point of views. I'll listen to anybody. I don't mind what a person believes in or thinks as long as he's sincere. I like sincerity in people. I don't like people to say, "Oh, I believe in something," if deep down they don't. I mean, person believes in religion. Okay, if he's a religious man, I'll accept it. I'm non-religious myself, but I'll accept anybody's views. I had a young lady come here the other week, and she wanted to say a prayer for me because I've got MS, and she said, "God can cure you." I said, "Well, I doubt it very much. There's not been a cure found for it. God would cure." She wanted to say a prayer. She was sincere. I said, "Okay, you say it." Well, of course, it didn't work. But I like sincerity in people, yeah. So otherwise, it never. At first, of course, I was a bit miserable, I suppose, when I arrived home. People at home didn't really take to it very much, what we were writing home and things like that. I mean, we were always asking our mums and dads to fight for peace and things like that, hurry up and get this war over, anything for that. And I suppose they didn't go a lot on our views when I came home. I was interviewed several times.
I
Have we
remember.
ever seen any, by everybody, Associated Press, UP? I upset them. Have you ever seen any atrocity? I said no. They didn't want to know anymore. When we got home, of course, we had Daily Express and local papers, Southern papers, the Southern Daily Echo it used to be then. Daily Express, Daily Mirror, people like those. And they all wanted to interview, and I gave them what I thought. I've got some copies of them. Did you ever see this? And I said atrocity reports are lies on one heading because, in my view, atrocities weren't carried out. This idea of tying people up and shooting, I've never seen it. Never seen it, ever. And we were the first British they captured, some of the first British captured.
When they reported what you said, did they give an accurate report of what you'd said?
Yes, but they used to put in a few sly pieces, especially the local newspaper I found, which were all run by Daily Express and people like that, aren't they? My father, who I lived at home then with my mum and dad in Bognor, and my father, while I was out there, a reporter had come round to see him one day, and a day worker was popped through the letterbox with some information about me when my name was first. And they wrote in the local paper that week that a mysterious stranger had popped a copy of the Daily Worker in. You see, it was such a terrible thing, that he should receive a copy of the Daily Worker. And my father was a conservative, never ever a communist. But every article they wrote after I came home was, readers will remember that Mr. Richards received mysterious calls from this sort of thing. They tried to make. And I was a bit annoyed about that. I think that's such a lot of old ballyhoo. But I'm over that way now. And I tried to get into the police force when I came out, the forces, out of the Marines. They said I was A1, but the police said I was unfit. Whether it's because of what I've been through, I feel it was. Fact, I know it was.